So I think it was Abdurrahim, Tom, who told me that you all had the events of Paris on your minds. Is that right? And somewhat? Because I said, you know, I had asked him whether you had suggested something to talk about. And
I didn't suggest it. I think we mentioned it in passing.
Yeah. Right. You know, and since Sufism is all embracing and all penetrating, you can start from anywhere and talk about Sufism. So we can start from there. That's a good place. You know, how does this happen? And why does this happen in a field of a religion that calls itself, you know, religion of compassion, of love, and that's because Islam is an inner thing. It's of the inner being. It's a transformation of the inner being, or a return of the inner being to its origin and to its source. And so if that doesn't happen, the outer will not be sufficient, you know. And if the outer were, maybe one could say, truly practiced, completely practiced, then yes, but it's subtle. It's subtle, because each of those things that we call the five pillars of Islam is like a node with all of these branching kind of synapses that lead from it. And the node by itself is not alive. It's alive when it's in this context of mercy and when it's guided by people of Gnostic wisdom. And that's what the Sufi lineages are. So we can say something is Islam, but it might just be cultural. It's cultural. It's an identity. It can be a cultural identity, a religious identity, a psychological identity that we call ourselves by the name of our religion. But are we really living up to that? Are we going to the essence of that? Is the question. And so, as we know, the outer forms of religion in the hands of people whose minds and hearts have become sealed and distorted is very dangerous, you know. And we know it happens in all the religions can show effects like that. As we know, the auto da fe, Christianity, and burning people and burning books, and, you know, it's a little similar to what ISIS is doing now. So this is why, you know, we belong to a mystic order, and it's not different from Islam. It's the heart of Islam. It's really the heart of Islam. And without it, you just get the body. And the body by itself does not do very well. It will become, you know, decrepit very quickly. And Islam has always, real true Islam is in the tariqas, is in the Sufi orders. It's not something separate. And as the Sufi orders have, in a sense, spilled out their light and infused the society and the culture with beautiful ways of being and inspired, you know, forms of living, then you get, you know, what you might call a true Islamic society. But if it doesn't have the Sufi lineages within it, it is not a true Islamic society. So we know some of the reasons why these terrible tragedies happen. And but when we can't blame a sacred path for that. We have to blame, you know, certainly historical circumstances. We have to look at colonialism. We have to look at oppression. We have to look at social stratification. We have to look at, and then on the other hand, on the Islamic side, we have to look at a hardening. We have to look at a, as I say, a
intolerance,
but which comes from the fact that it's separate from its heart. Then it becomes judgmental, intolerant, rigid. We know these words. This is what we often associate with religion, in fact. You know, so if the sacred path misses its heart, which is the way, the path to transform the heart into what it truly is, which is the place of God, then you're going to always have, you know, distortion. And then it can be, you know, different degrees. But the human being is said to be, in Quran, the highest level of creation, because we contain everything. We're familiar with this also in the Renaissance, because the Renaissance took some of these ideas and you know, manifested them in beautiful ways. And so the human being was called the microcosm. Effendi actually said the human being is the macrocosm, and the universe is the microcosm. So what we see as big is actually small. It's like we're looking in the mirror. We're really seeing ourselves as we look out there, but we don't know that. We don't know that all of that is really in ourselves. So the human being is so vast, so complex, so subtle, so beautiful, that you need masters who have died to their limited self to be the guides of what it means to be human, and to, you know, using the prophetic tradition and embodying the prophetic tradition and helping to transmit it. That is the only thing that really works for humanity, you know, because God and the prophets are one, and the prophets are like the alchemy for all humanity. And what we call the prophets are beings in all sacred paths. Prophets are mothers, are, you know, men and women who are one with God. And only the teachers, those great teachers who are one with God, can really reveal the divine essence in each of us. So this is why we connect, this is why we're part of the river of the prophetic tradition. We live in the river, we're like fish in the river. And without that river, we dry up. Humanity dries up and becomes, you know, what we know. Secular, let's say the far end of secular is what, you know, we've seen in communism and, you know, some of the distortions that come from that. And then we have, as I said, we just talked about the other side. So without the sacred paths of the heart, humanity is really going in a lost way. So that's my little talk about Paris, and to, you know, get some of the levels. There are different levels from which to understand it. Another level, which is, again, it's a level, what we call a level of tawhid, a level of looking from a place more of unity and mercy, is that what looks terrible can bring good. And so I think good will come from this. You know, not just that, but from this whole upheaval of humanity and migration of humanity and conflict of humanity. But it will bring about a deepening of the human society and of human beings, because, you know, it's often when we're confronted and when we're challenged and when we actually suffer that we grow. And if we're just left in our little niches doing what we know how to do so well, we don't evolve. We don't become who we really are. We don't discover the divine within. So that's, the higher level. Now, you don't say that, of course, to people who've just experienced tragedy, but we kind of know it in our heart that it will come to something better than there was before. Inshallah. We always say inshallah. That's another piece of mystic wisdom. It's kind of saying inshallah. I'm sure you've come across that, right? Meaning, if God wills it, if God desires it, then it will be. Not because I say so, or I think so, or it should be, and from my point of view, not at all. So the true Muslim, the one who has submitted, it's not really submission of one to another, it's really an immersion, it's a disappearance in God. That's the real Islam, is when you disappear into the source. You return to who you really are, and your mind returns. So you no longer think two, you no longer think separate, you no longer think, I am a separate being, living and doing what I want, and trying to live my life the way I think it should be. And no, that's ignorance. That is what we call ignorance. Knowledge is when we give ourselves up, and it's when we have faith that the one being is guiding us and guiding everything in the universe and is the universe, or the universe is that, or that is the universe. So it's a very, very different state of being from what we're trained, from the way we're trained in school and, in society. So the mystic path is almost it's the obverse. It's the opposite. So these are just a few words to spark some more questions. Yes, that's Fadi. Oh, no, well, first I think, Fadi, we have students, and Fadi is a perpetual student, I know. You'll come back. But this is a class that's visiting, so I just want to give them precedence.
And I identify with the students.
You do. I am a student. That's good. I know you're a student. Well, then ask your question.
It's interesting where we hear a lot about heaven and hell and the hellfire. And there's an interesting, I don't recall who the translator was of the Quran that I was reading, but it was interesting that there is kind of like almost an interesting slippage of, it was no longer said, the phrase did not say fire simply, but fire in the heart, in parentheses.
Oh, good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that pointing to the fact that we create our heaven and we create our hell. Yeah. That's what the Sufis say. There is no separate place called hell. I mean, hell is a state, and we know it. We've tasted it in ourselves, and it's what we create. So, thank you for clarifying that. Yes?
So,
just call me Fariha. Yeah, please, yes. Fariha.
We hear a lot about attacks on Sufis.
About attacks on
people
Sufis.
People attacking Sufis and blowing up Sufis.
Right.
Why do they dislike you guys so much?
Yeah, that's a good question. Why has the truth, been denied? Why were the prophets, crucified, burned, killed? I mean, exactly. Because it's a very strange phenomenon where what is the best for us, we deny. If our heart is closed, that's the thing, and we don't see, and it's frightening. I think people do it also out of fear, that Sufism opens up such a huge ocean. So it's like you're sitting next to a nice swimming pool and, you know, you can see everything and it's all in order. And then all of a sudden, someone draws a curtain and then you see an endless ocean. It can be terrifying, you know. I think that's one of the reasons that people of that nature, who were very rigid and kind of orthodox, I mean, not in the true sense, but in the sense of following dogma and rules, and they're inside of this, their rational and kind of boxed out mind is probably a heart that's in great fear, you know, in great fear of Huck, in great fear of the reality. And, it goes against their plan, certainly, Sufis, and then it's also that thing. I mean, these things are very psychological that, thank goodness, we're dealing with today in our society, you know, that if you don't feel happy, well, you certainly don't want to see other people happy and dancing and singing to God, you know, because you want everything to be miserable the way you're miserable. So, and I think that's actually one explanation for why those dogmatists, you know, blow up shrines and kill people, and yeah, so, you know, but it's so interesting. The great Sufis have encountered this all the time. Ibn Arabi, you know, they want to kill Ibn Arabi, who's one of the greatest beings of all time, and those were the dogmatists at his time, the so-called Muslims. Sheikh Muzaffar, who's our guide, who brought this tradition from the East, said, the hardest thing is to make a Muslim a Muslim. So what he meant by that, the hardest thing is to take someone who is culturally Muslim, who's so convinced of their beliefs. And this is where, in the religion, you know, everyone can become so dogmatic and so sure that they have the way, and to strip that from them, to make them naked. Because we have to become naked, we need to become empty. In fact, the path of Sufism is really emptying ourself of ourself, being emptied out, you know. And so unless we do that, it's like the metaphor, you know, if you don't come with your cup empty, it's not going to be filled in the fountain. If you come with it full, and the so-called cultural ones are full already, their cup is full, they know everything. From whatever tradition, again, it's not just Islam. But, so it's a daring path. We don't know how daring it is until we're already in it. You know, Rumi said, my God, if I knew what awaited me, you know, the blood, I never would have entered in. But he also means even entering into life. And that's something that is talked about too, how the soul doesn't even want to enter into the body or into creation because it's in a state of blissful unity. And there are stories about that, humorous stories, you know, how when God then wants the soul to go into the body and this tiny little space there, and the soul says, no, I'm not entering that, you know. And then it says that some traditions say then that God started to play music. And then with music, the soul became intoxicated and then went into the body in a drunken state. And then woke up. But that's why, you know, we love music, because it keeps us in that sort of boundless, intoxicated state. So Sufis are always, I mean, usually, not always, always, there are very, very sober, sober, sober Sufis that are not connected to music, but many orders are. Yeah.
I'm just thinking of Rumi and Shams too, because it's so amazing that these two pinnacles of Sufism, and yet most likely Shams was murdered by some of Rumi's yeah. disciples.
Right. Yeah, that's an amazing thing.
Rumi and Shams, I mean, Rumi you've all heard of, I'm sure, the poet Rumi, from Iran, Persia, Khorasan. And his teacher was this man named Shams, whose name means the sun, and he was like this wandering dervish, and he was quite intoxicated. And he really made Rumi into the high being that he was, and there were a lot of people that were jealous, so they murdered him. Some of his disciples some of his disciples got very jealous of their relationship and how close they were and the love between them. So even at that level, I mean, Rumi's disciples were quite a high level of spiritual advancement, and yet they still couldn't get over their jealousy.
Well, that's called, you know, a murder of passion. It's a different. In fact, even, I think it was in Italy, you know, they call murders of passion, they see it in a different light.
This country, too. Crimes of passion.
Yeah. Okay.
It's only been recently that it's become like a criminal thing to murder your beloved one.
Before it was just fine.
Italy, especially.
Italy is known for that. It's true. So, yes.
There's a question.
Because he had a question, too.
Okay.
Okay, but are you the student?
No.
No, I'll come to you after her, just because, again, I'm giving her precedence.
Thank you.
What's your name?
Brenna.
Brenna. Mm-hmm. Brenna.
Brenna.
Mm-hmm. Brenna.
Yeah. So I was just wondering what that kind of made me think about, you know, like even these high disciples still fall into sin. Would you consider, like, jealousy sin? Is that just like what?
Well, on that, sure, if you go and kill someone, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
especially a sheikh of his stature, absolutely a sin.
So, even if you. So, what do you think about sin and how is sin absolved? Is it absolved?
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, one of the repeating. Themes in Quran is that God is all forgiving, and in fact, there's a very explicit statement that says, you know, I am the all forgiving. I forgive every sin, every transgression. So, if that is, you know, in the kind of foundation, then sin is not such a terrible thing. As it would be if God were not that forgiving, you know, then it would be terrible because you would be kind of doomed. Because it says, and Allah even says in Quran, if you did not transgress, if you did not sin, I would take you off from the face of the earth and bring in a people who would sin. Can you imagine? So, sin is, I mean, sin, we don't so much, we use the word transgression more, you know, transgressing boundaries, because sin, just to sort of distinguish it from more the Christian view of sin and the fall and all of that, the original sin. There is not that in Islam. It does say that every person comes with a little clot of darkness in their heart, except, interestingly enough, for Jesus and Mary. And that also is said in Quran. They were the only ones who came free of that. Even the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, came with this little clot in the heart, which is, it's like the touch of the devil, sort of, you know. But it was removed when he was two by angelic beings, archangels. And so, but so, transgressing is part of our nature, but the way the transgression becomes absolved, as you say, or even a form of healing, is when we ask for forgiveness. So obviously, if we just go on transgressing unconsciously, it's not good. That's definitely not a good thing, because we become burdened by it. Every time we transgress, it's like, sure, it's like a little, you might say, shadow around the heart or something like that. But when we return, when we sit with before the All-Merciful One and we say, forgive me, please, you know, then it's removed. It is removed. And part of our faith is actually to believe that. So it would be a lack of faith if we thought that, oh God, cannot, you know, my sins are so bad or what I do is so bad that God will never forgive me, or that would be actually considered a lesser form of faith. So it's a dynamic, and you find that some of the most mature beings, like, you know, their prayers of Imam Ali, who was the cousin of the Prophet and is also his son-in-law, I think, married Fatima. So, alayhi salam. His prayers, you think, he's saying, you know, how wrong he's been doing. So you think, how could such an exalted being, you know, be transgressing? But all depends on the level. From his point of view, he is. You know, it said, in fact, the Islamic teaching is that only the prophets are perfect. So only the prophets have no sin at all. It's interesting. So all of the Old Testament prophets, all of, you know, prophets from all over, if they're on the level of Nabi, and there are said to be 124,000 at least of prophets, some people say 224,000, some traditions, those are all the ones who have not and cannot transgress, even if it might look that way. They might look like they make errors, but that's just for teaching others, you know. Yeah. So that partly makes our humility, you know. If we didn't transgress, first of all, God would have an attribute, a quality, which is part of the compassion, part of the Rahman, which is the forgiveness. So Allah wants to forgive. And if there's no one to forgive, it said, then Allah wouldn't be able to bestow that. Wouldn't, you know, it's like if you have overflowing love in your heart. And we can even imagine that ourselves, you know. So much love that we actually want, you know, someone to make a mistake so we can pour out our love on them and say, it's okay, you know, I forgive you. It's kind of, I mean, that's a very simplified form, but of what it is. So the interaction of human and divine is totally one. It's a dynamic. And the human being, that's us, we are the divine qualities. And as those interact and relate to the divine essence, you know. So it's a journey, really, of God in God, the human life. But unless we wake up to that, you could say our life is not lived, let's say, to the degree it can be lived. You know, some would say it's wasted, because human life is so precious. If you understand that dimension and the vastness of it, that if we just live, we can live a perfectly, you know, like more or less tranquil life on earth. But if you don't enter into that divine dimension of yourself, then you miss really the essence. Yeah. Farid, where are you going?
I'm picking up.
A what?
Getting a chair. He's getting a chair.
Oh, good. Okay. Good.
I don't know what you call these.
Back check.
I don't know.
He's getting a back check.
Yeah. So, are there any other questions? Yeah.
Hi.
Hi.
It's Maxine.
Maxine.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Thanks for having us.
I love to have you. And we all love to have you.
I have a quick question. Maybe it's not so quick, but I'm curious as to how Sufis interpret the perhaps aggressive nature of the Medina surahs in the Quran and Prophet Muhammad.
The aggressive nature of what?
The Medina surahs in the Quran. And perhaps how that, whatever the response is to that nature, how it perhaps kind of plays a role in what you just described with regards to
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's true, the Quran can be quite intense. God is intense, you know. God is very intense, and human beings are very intense. So it's a passionate life. This is not you know, just something vanilla, definitely. So the passion there is the passion also of expressing the pain over injustice, you know, and the pain over ignorance, and the pain over heedlessness, and willful, you know, willful wrongdoing. I think that's what that what we see as, oh, you know, the upsetness of Allah there is that. So on one level, Allah, if we speak of Allah on, as the ultimate reality, the Haq, the Ein Sof, then, or the essence, you know, that essence is, doesn't, you know, necessarily seem to, is not disturbed at all, you could say, on some level by what happens here. But as that essence manifests, overflows, creates this realm of manifestation, and then it participates in it. And it directs it and guides it, and it is it. There's nothing else here. La ilaha illallah is really what the Sufis and, you know, the people of heart say. That only one reality alone. This is, we think that there's us and God, you know, that's a common thought we all have, you know, and we live in that sort of world of duality most of the time. But if we take a path of unity, we will come to a place where, you know, that separate self dissolves and merges into that ocean of unity. And so, really, there's only God here, you know. But to taste that and know that, it requires a path. So if you say, oh, God is so angry, well, it's just a manifestation of the justice of God, of the love of God, of the disappointment of God against the qualities that are still coming from God of injustice and, as I said, you know, these other traits. So it's a real, seems like a paradox. But that's one level of seeing. That's the Sufi level. That's the level of unity, of seeing things. But we don't want to be on the side of injustice, even though to say, well, that's also God's attributes, you know, or that's God's, let's say, actions. God is as much in the person who's the murderer, not as much, but let's say some aspects are. But we don't want to be that person. We don't want to, because that's not the fullness of God. That's not the beauty and the mercy and the felicity, you know. So therefore, even though we say all is God, but there is still a better place to be in God. That's how I explain. It's not a, you know, maybe it's very to explain God's upsetness is coming from love. That's what I want to say ultimately. It's like if you love someone and that person is just being so stupid and harming themselves, you know, aren't you going to get upset? You know, that's, to put it in human terms, that's why it looks that way. Yeah. But the lovers of God take that wrath and are inspired by it. They actually, some of the lovers love that. Like Sheikh Muzaffar said that sometimes the thorn of the rose is better than the rose. Why? Because the thorn is that pain of love. The thorn is what also moves you on, is what, you know, wakens the lover. The rose is wonderful and great, but so that there is that dimension of passion, yes, in the relationship to God, definitely. Yeah. That was an interesting question. Yeah, thank you, Maxine. Mm-hmm. And then you had our brother here. You had the question.
Mm. It was from before.
Oh, it was from before?
The question was about why Sufism would be a threat. And I heard some of your answer about full-heartedness, you might call it, or sukkah.
Uh-huh.
And I think there's some sense in which that sort of open-heartedness makes us redefine or perhaps even destroy, I don't know, our relationship to dogma.
To dogma.
To dogma.
To dogma, yes, of course, that's true.
So then my question is, what is the right relationship between open-heartedness and dogma?
Uh-huh. You know, on the Sufi path, dogma does not exist. There is no dogma. Even though in the beginning of the path, you know, there's certain things, but there's not that much dogma in Islam. It's more a vision, you could say. We have the vision of the essence, the vision of the 99 names, and the vision of the 1,001 names, and the vision of the 3,300 names, and of the infinite name. You know, all these are like radiant from the sun, so you could say. And these are visions of our understanding is given by mystics or by prophets who have experienced this directly and who are transmitting it to us. So it's not like dogma in that sense. It's different, you know. Even though some Muslims can be extremely dogmatic, but on the Sufi path, there's no dogma. It's just lover and beloved, really. And then even beyond that, it's just the one. So we disappear. So we're not people who hold a dogma, or we should not be, let's say, to be on the path. You can't go very far on the path with dogma on your path. You either have to let it go, drop it, and become naked, as I said, become empty. So being empty means empty of thought, being empty of what we think, and which is what dogma is in a way. It's a dogma. I mean, and I don't want to belittle dogma, you know, it, and many profound people live with it, and but I'm just speaking maybe more from this point of view of Sufism. It doesn't exist. So the mystic, in fact, is said is the one who's bewildered. Far from being dogmatic, they're bewildered because every experience they have of God can be contradictory. So they will see God in one way, in one time, and then they'll see God in another way at the other time. They might see God, yes, more as this Jalal power, this all, you know, dominating power, and then another moment they'll see God in an extremely gentle and almost feminine form, or God as a person, or God in a cat, or, you know, so... So there's no place for dogma there. It's just pure experience. In fact, the real, and this is what Ibn Arabi points to, place of knowledge is the heart where God reveals God. So God reveals, Allah reveals Allah in our hearts continuously. So imagine that we have that continuously happening in our hearts, only we're not aware of it. You know, we might be affected by it without our knowing somewhat, but we're not completely. It's like exactly like a clouded vessel or something, you know, and as the vessel clears you can see better, and that's God's own self-revelation within each of our hearts, which is amazing. So it's not just like great mystics. Everybody is a mystic. Everybody has this going on. But it's, you know, do we have the thirst or the desire to attain it, to see it, to realize it, to give up everything, really, ultimately, for that, to be in that place with God. So, yeah. Good.
Can I say, ask something, because we're talking about human annihilation in God, and then, you know, I was thinking, contemplating today, you know, that in life, and on the path, you know, you seek God, but then you seek yourself, you know, and that full sort of your own identity, you know, and in the light of you know, in the light of that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so what I'm asking really mm-hmm. is, you know, that journey to your own identity.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because it's a parallel journey in some mm-hmm. way. Mm-hmm. That, you know, you have, yeah. you see, you know, you cannot seek God without mm-hmm. seeking yourself.
True, absolutely. Share the hadith, which says, you know.
Oh, to know thyself. Yeah. You know. You say it.
Yeah, it's know yourself and you will know your Lord. So you're, yes, this is true, that know yourself and you know your Lord.
It's a very interesting journey because, yeah. you know, in some way, of course, especially when you, I think, enter the path, mm-hmm. you seek to annihilate, you know, to mm-hmm. lose your identity. Mm-hmm. It's interesting,
right?
You know, but then
you're
of
empty.
Course,
yeah.
yes, and a lot of that is going on,
mm-hmm.
and you kind of get showered with mm-hmm. things, mm-hmm. you know, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You get filled with things that seem to come up from outside of yourself, from a divine source, but mm-hmm. outside of yourself mm-hmm. in some way. That's mm-hmm. at least my experience,
mm-hmm.
and then you know you, but then. You know, I think as the path goes on, you
right.
you really get, you know, pushed into your own identity. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's mm-hmm. very interesting, mm-hmm. you know, that suddenly, you know, you are, you know, the focal point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's
mm-hmm.
interesting.
Yes,
you know?
It's true.
So I just wanted to,
right.
you know, say that because
right.
we've been talking a lot about that sort of annihilation.
And that's
but then, and then you said that everyone here and everyone in the world is a mystic, and that's
yes.
what I was trying to say in the light of that, because
right.
every identity, every being
right.
is that, you know,
right.
is already that revelation
right.
in
right.
that sense. It's just, are you conscious of it, or
are you
conscious?
Not conscious of it? Right.
I think, you know, which is very subtle,
right.
but it's a very
right.
big thing, but it's
right.
a very subtle thing.
Right, right. Well, it you know, what you're saying is also said, again, by the mystics, that you will only know of God, you know, through yourself, through your own lens. So, in that sense. But our lens is much, much vaster than we think it is. But so it is. It's a finding yourself. But it's not the self that we know, you know, in the beginning of the path. It's a different self. It's really God's self as oneself. So we are each, yes, you could say like a clear diamond in water. So there's the water and the diamond, or there's no metaphor actually that completely explains what the mystery is. But what you're saying is true, that we have a beautiful lahi that says that wait, how's it go? It goes, Iblis, who's the devil, seeks him, Iblis seeks you and finds but himself. And Adam seeks himself and finds only you. So the journey of the human being is to God and is God, you know. But as you say, we have to, whatever makes us conscious, whatever is revealing, it's God who reveals. And, you know, some people are, it can happen early, some people later, but eventually it'll happen to everyone, you know, whether in this world or the next, where we will realize that everything that we are is that. Everything we are is that.